Flu Fears. With the history of the false smallpox epidemic in Kansas City as an indication of corporate malfeasance, one should look at who profits from pandemics. With swine flu, there should be public scrutiny of Baxter International, the giant worldwide pharmaceutical conglomerate that was given millions to develop a swine flu vaccine. In 2008, 44% of its total profits, $5.3 billion, came from pharmaceuticals and vaccines. In 2010, several websites were claiming that President Obama, as a senator in 2005, bought $50,000 worth of stock shares in two companies, one being Baxter. Apparently, in March 2005, Senator Obama attached an amendment to the Foreign Relations Committee Authorization Act, S-600, authorizing $25 million for international efforts to combat the avian influenza. On April 28, 2005, Obama introduced the Avian Act, S-969, a comprehensive bill addressing the threat of an avian flu pandemic. Interestingly enough, major outbreaks of the avian flu took place in 2006 and 2007, which prompted some to wonder how Obama could have known about the problem in 2005. Baxter has been the center of several controversies, one of which was the adulteration of an avian flu vaccine with a pathogen. In late February 2009, a batch of the usual seasonal flu vaccines from a Baxter lab in Austria was contaminated with live H5N1 avian flu viruses, which has a 60% kill rate, and shipped to subcontractors in several countries. Luckily, some cautious researchers in the Czech Republic decided to inject the vaccine into laboratory ferrets to observe any side effects. The ferrets all died. Baxter officials quickly said the offending vaccines were destroyed and that preventative and corrective measures had been instituted. Baxter's distribution of the adulterated flu vaccine caused concern. To many, it illustrated how sloppy corporate handling of deadly viruses could break out into a full-blown public disaster, and others even saw this as an attempt to spread a pandemic for which the company could provide an antidote. For a price, of course. Christopher Bona, Baxter's director of general bioscience communications, confirmed that the experimental virus material contained live avian flu virus, but explained this was the result of just the process itself and technical and human error in this procedure. One great fear of combining seasonal flu virus with a virulent avian flu virus, a process called reassortment, is that such mixing could produce new hybrid bird-human viruses with dire consequences for the human population. The Czech media publicly questioned if Baxter's distribution of the deadly virus might have been a conspiracy to initiate a multi-nation pandemic, a charge that may not be that absurd. According to routine laboratory protocols for vaccine makers, it is virtually impossible to accidentally mix a deadly live virus with a vaccine. Mike Adams, editor of Natural News and a former trial tester for pharmaceutical companies, wrote, "Baxter is acting a whole lot like a biological terrorism organization these days, sending deadly viral samples around the world. If you mail an envelope full of anthrax to your senator, you get arrested as a terrorist. So why is Baxter, which mailed samples of a far more deadly viral strain to labs around the world, getting away with saying, essentially, oops?" It seems Baxter has a long history of problems and controversies with its operations as well as its products. Beginning in the mid-1990s, more than a half dozen persons in the United Kingdom tried to sue Baxter, Bayer, and four other pharmaceutical firms in the United States, claiming all had shipped blood contaminated with the HIV virus to Britain. The suits were continuing in 2007 after an American judge ordered the case moved to the United Kingdom. In 2008, Baxter was charged with the distribution of contaminated doses of the Chinese-produced drug heparin, a blood thinner that is used in kidney dialysis. The heparin was provided to Baxter by Scientific Protein Laboratories of Wanakee, Wisconsin, and emanated from its plant in Changzhou City, China. The company is Baxter's main supplier of the active pharmaceutical ingredient in heparin. In 2009, Baxter's subsidiary, Baxter Healthcare Corporation, settled a suit over excessive Medicaid billing in Kentucky for $2 million. Following an investigation, that state's Attorney General, Jack Conway, had charged Baxter with charging the Kentucky Medicaid program inflated average wholesale prices for its intravenous solutions, bearing no relationship to prices the firm charged its customers. This created an artificial large gap between Baxter's published prices and the real prices. At times, this difference exceeded 1,300%, causing the Kentucky Medicaid program to pay substantially more for Baxter's drugs than their actual cost. On August 15, 2001, two elderly patients in Spain died within hours of receiving dialysis from Baxter products. Eventually, 51 more patients would die. Though the cause was unclear, the company issued a worldwide recall of Baxter's two lines of filters, the sole common link between all the equipment used by the patients. Harry Kramer, the company president at the time, apologized for the errors, shut down the factory producing filters, alerted competitors of the issue, and took a 40% pay cut along with a 20% cut for other executives. The company's earnings dropped by $189 million as a result of the issues. The company took quick action to reduce the impact of the event and prevent future recurrence, and as a result suffered minimal damage to its reputation. Despite Baxter's troubled past, at the end of 2009, the company remained one of the top contenders for making the swine flu vaccine. This is perhaps due to the fact that in 2008, Baxter was the first pharmaceutical company to announce the development of a swine flu vaccine. What is suspicious about the timing of Baxter's 2008 announcement is that the company applied for a patent on several viruses, including swine flu, on August 28, 2007. Nearly 2 years before the disease was said to have suddenly appeared in Mexico. The fortuitous timing of Baxter's patent claim provides much grist for the mills of conspiracy theorists. One of Baxter's competitors was Novartis Pharmaceuticals. In 2006, Novartis acquired the Chiron Vaccine Company, which at the time was embroiled in controversy after Britain's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency suspended the company's license to make the influenza vaccine Fluvirin in 2004. Both firms had agreements with the World Health Organization to produce a pandemic vaccine. Author, lecturer, and neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock warned, "The Baxter swine flu vaccine called Selvapan has had fast-track approval. It uses a new Verocell technology which utilizes cultured cells from the African green monkey. This same animal tissue transmits a number of vaccine-contaminating viruses, including the HIV virus. Adjuvants are oil-based additives placed in vaccines that prompt the body to create antibodies against the targeted virus. Adjuvants can cause extreme inflammation. Animals injected with such adjuvants develop painful, incurable autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, or systemic lupus." Blaylock said that after reviewing a number of studies on the adjuvant MF59, which contains squalene, he noticed something interesting. Several studies done on human test subjects found MF59 to be a very safe immune adjuvant. But when I checked to see who did these studies, I found, to no surprise, that they were done by the Novartis Pharmaceutical Company and Chiron Pharmaceutical Company, which have merged. They were all published in prestigious medical journals. Also, to no surprise, a great number of studies done by independent laboratories and research institutions all found a strong link between MF59 and autoimmune diseases. It is interesting to note that Daniel Vasella, chairman and CEO of Novartis, has regularly attended the secretive Bilderberg meetings since 1998. One would be foolhardy to believe that sheer coincidence could explain that, Just 2 months after the 2009 Bilderberg meeting in Athens, the U.S. government gave Novartis $690 million to manufacture swine flu vaccines. It should be no secret how such deals are accomplished, considering the globalists in government service who attend Bilderberg meetings, such as Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and others. It might also be noted that Novartis came from the 1996 merger of Ciba Geigy and Sandoz Laboratories, both originally German entities and part of the massive IG Farben chemical cartel. The full name is Interessengemeinschaft Farben Industrie Aktiengesellschaft, or Syndicate of Dyestuff Industry Corporations. It was the world's greatest chemical drug combine from its inception in 1925 and a major supporter of the Nazi regime until broken up by the Allies at the end of World War II. This, once again, establishes a clear link between the old German Nazis who desired to clean up the human gene pool by killing off undesirables and the giant pharmaceutical houses of today, run by globalists who also desire to trim the human herd. Pot busts are high. In early 2009, with the economy stumbling and corruption constantly being revealed in high places, our nation's lawmen were on the job. The National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, NORML, reported that FBI statistics showed marijuana arrests were at an all-time high, no pun intended. Since 1965, marijuana arrests climbed from a mere 2 per hour to 100 per hour in 2008. In 2008, the FBI's Uniform Crime Report stated that police had arrested a record 872,721 persons for marijuana violations in 2007, the largest total number of annual arrests for cannabis ever recorded by the FBI. Marijuana arrests composed nearly 47.5% of all drug arrests in the United States, with almost 3 in 4 of those arrested under age 30. According to NORML Executive Director Alan St. Pierre, of those arrested for marijuana violations, approximately 89%, or 775,138 Americans, were only charged with possession. These numbers belie the myth that police do not target and arrest minor cannabis offenders, said St. Pierre. This effort is a tremendous waste of criminal justice resources that diverts law enforcement personnel away from focusing on serious and violent crime, including the war on terrorism. The remaining 97,583 individuals, 11%, were charged with sale or manufacture, a category that includes all cultivation offenses, even those where the marijuana was being grown for personal or medical use. Often, those arrested are guilty of victimless crimes. One 20-year-old Texas man used to make money selling small amounts of pot. He had a deal with local deputies. If he was caught, he had to share some of his stash before the cops left him alone. But the 20-year-old made a mistake when he was stopped in an adjoining Texas county. After being arrested for possession of a small quantity of weed, the man was offered probation, but could not afford the probation fees and was forced to plead guilty. He now carries a felony record for the rest of his life, with all the restrictions that implies. Alan St. Pierre noted that annual marijuana arrests have nearly tripled since the early 1990s, while arrests for cocaine and heroin declined in the same period. St. Pierre concluded, "Arresting hundreds of thousands of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly needlessly destroys the lives of otherwise law-abiding citizens, and increases enforcement of marijuana laws is being achieved at the expense of enforcing laws against the possession and trafficking of more dangerous drugs. Enforcing marijuana prohibition costs taxpayers between $10 billion and $12 billion annually and has led to the arrest of nearly 20 million Americans. Nevertheless, nearly 100 million Americans acknowledge having used marijuana during their lives. It makes no sense to continue to treat nearly half of all Americans as criminals for their use of a substance that poses far fewer health risks than alcohol or tobacco. A better and more sensible solution would be to tax and regulate cannabis in a manner similar to alcohol and tobacco." Observers of the modern drug scene are amazed at how it only took 14 years for our great-grandparents to realize that alcohol prohibition not only was not working, but in fact was creating a worse problem than the alcohol. Police and judicial corruption, the rise of bootleggers and crime syndicates, and the large number of otherwise innocents caught up in the criminal justice system. In 1933, both the prohibition laws and the constitutional amendment were amended and alcohol became controlled and taxed, but legal. It is interesting to note that laws against marijuana came into being just as prohibition was on the way out. Perhaps this changeover is explained by the fact that Harry Anslinger, assistant prohibition commissioner in the Bureau of Prohibition, was about to lose his job. Fortunately, he successfully lobbied Congress to pass anti-marijuana laws just before being appointed as the first commissioner of the Treasury Department's newly formed Federal Bureau of Narcotics. Conspiracy researchers have long suspected that the disparity between pot arrests and those for cocaine and heroin may be explained by allegations that the harder drugs, such as cocaine and heroin, cannot be easily produced at home and are imported by people working within the U.S. government to fund off-the-books operations. Such allegations stretch all the way back past the Vietnam War, but this is a story for another day. Natural News editor Mike Adams has pointed out that all commercial hemp used by Americans for textiles, nutritional supplements, soaps, and ropes is imported from China, Canada, India, Chile, and many other countries. Meanwhile, American farmers suffer under increasing debt and decreasing revenues from stalled crop prices. The DEA makes no differentiation between industrial hemp and marijuana. To the DEA, it's all the same crop, never mind that smoking industrial hemp will only make you vomit, not high, and anyone caught planting hemp will be arrested and prosecuted using the same laws that were really only intended to halt hardcore street drug pushers. As anyone who isn't smoking crack has already figured out, and even a few who are, America's drug policy is a scandalous failure. Not only has the so-called war on drugs utterly failed to stop the flow of recreational drugs in America, it has criminalized struggling farmers who seek to grow industrial hemp as a profitable, renewable crop that's in high demand across multiple industries. The war on drugs has accomplished one thing, though. It has filled the nation's prisons with small-time offenders who got caught with an ounce or two of weed in their pockets. America's drug policy, it seems, is a boon for the prison industry, but a curse upon our nation's farmers, wrote Adams. The arrests for marijuana and the fines that come with the arrests are a boon for the global socialist fascist intent on tagging every citizen with a computer number. Jeffrey A. Tucker, editor of the website for the Ludwig von Mises Institute, a research and educational center of classical liberalism and libertarian political theory, was taken aback in late 2009 when he read in his local Alabama newspaper about the arrest of 25 persons on methamphetamine-related charges. He thought it was amazing that all these people had meth labs in his hometown. But what caught his attention more were the published photos of the accused. Old people, young people, long-haired and short-haired people, and every other type. A cross-section of rural America, thought Tucker. He noticed that the arrests stemmed from a 3-month-long drug investigation that targeted individuals who were purchasing over the legal amount of pseudoephedrine, according to a release from the Lee County Sheriff's Office. Only one of those arrested was charged with the unlawful manufacturing of a controlled substance. This, we might presume, is the man with the meth lab, though we don't know for sure, said Tucker, noting that prior to 2005, one could buy as many Sudafed packages as you did Big Mac sandwiches, and the police didn't care. Now your 30-day allotment is 9 grams, so this seems like it would be enough. But what if you were buying for 2 people, or an entire family, or lose some, or give them away to a friend, or they fall to the back of the cabinet, or you're out of town? To me, this illustrates how regulations and rationing have a way of changing the subject from principles to practicalities, mused Tucker. What if there were a rule that said you can only purchase 30 triple whoppers from Burger King per person per month? Would we say, oh, no one needs more than that? Perhaps we would, But that is not the point. The point is that this is a violation of rights. Rationing of all types represents an egregious imposition on our right to choose. It weighs down daily life with arbitrary threats and increases the role of coercion in society. And this is true whether or not we actually bump up against the limits. Tucker pointed out that even despite the legislated banning of certain substances, the black market always found ways of proliferating and selling drugs. Whereas hundreds or thousands of pills used to be required to make meth, Bush's tough drug laws have led to new innovations, like the shake-and-bake method, which uses a legal number of pills and allows the user to make the stuff while driving. Yikes! That seems much more dangerous than texting while driving, he observed. Keep in mind that all this insanity is a result of the laws themselves. People are still using the drug, but they are now risking their lives to do so. In other words, the laws are not working, except to make meth production and use even more dangerous. The real horror to Tucker is the prohibition, which has brought about a dark despotism that everyone pretends not to notice. He says, to put it simply, this is an outrage, and it is even more disgusting that the local press is glad to play along with it. Here we have a nice illustration of how the police are used in an age of arbitrary law and despotic consumption controls. You become a criminal merely for buying today what was legal yesterday, and then society avoids you. You might be a druggie, and the suspicion alone is enough justification for you to be robbed of all rights and utterly smashed as a human being. Tucker was merely voicing what many Americans feel but are afraid to speak out about in the growing police state that is the modern United States. But slowly and with great resistance at the federal level, the level controlled by globalist fascists who profit from the flowing of drug money through their banking system, the people are reaching for a new vision of their country. By 2010, 14 states had legalized the use of marijuana for medical use, and more were moving in that direction. Of course, this will eventually beg the question, hey, if my neighbor can smoke pot legally because he has glaucoma, how come I get busted if I smoke some? The times, they are a-changing. But elsewhere, the screws are tightening. Suppression of citizens' rights through mandatory vaccinations of uncertain safety, unjust laws, unhealthy food and water, militarized law enforcement, unprovoked foreign wars, and crippling debt, both private and public, are only a part of the globalist fascist's long-term agenda to turn once free Americans into subservient and controlled zombies. Dumbed down education. The aim of totalitarian education has never been to instill convictions, but to destroy the capacity to form any. Hannah Arendt, social philosopher. Education can shape the brain of any person, even a zombie. Despite public claims to the contrary, education in America is, by almost every criterion, turning younger generations into dumbed down and ignorant zombies. Oklahoma School Study. In 2009, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs, the OCPA, enlisted a national research firm, Strategic Vision, to study student knowledge of civics. The test was taken from 10 questions used by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Candidates for U.S. citizenship must answer 6 questions correctly in order to become citizens. According to Immigration Service data, approximately 92% of those who take the citizenship test pass on their first try. The Oklahoma students did not do as well. The results indicated that only 1 in 4 Oklahoma public high school students could name the first president of the United States. Only about 3% of the 1,000 students surveyed would have passed the citizenship test. OCPA spokesman Brandon Dutcher said this is not just a problem in Oklahoma. According to Dutcher, Arizona students exhibited similar results. Matthew Ladner, vice president of research at the Goldwater Institute, commented that the results of this survey are deeply troubling. Despite billions of taxpayer dollars and a set of academic standards that cover all of the material, Oklahoma high school students display an overwhelming ignorance of the institutions that undergird political freedom. Those surveyed were high school students who already had completed multiple classes in social studies and history. Theoretically, if they had failed those classes, they would not have moved into high school. But the current educational philosophy dictates that self-esteem is more necessary than knowledge, and therefore these students were simply passed on to the next grade, regardless of their aptitude for the material. Here are the 10 questions used in the Oklahoma study. What is the supreme law of the land? What do we call the first 10 amendments to the Constitution? What are the two parts of the U.S. Congress? How many justices are there on the Supreme Court? Who wrote the Declaration of Independence? What ocean is on the east coast of the United States? What are the two major political parties in the United States? We elect a U.S. Senator for how many years? Who was the first President of the United States? Who is in charge of the executive branch? Recently, at least 26 states adopted stringent high school exit exams in an effort to promote increased learning. However, according to the New York Times, as deadlines approached for schools to start making passage of the exams a requirement for graduation, and practice tests indicated that large numbers of students would fail, many states softened standards, delayed the requirement, or added alternative paths to a diploma. The dumbed-down condition of the schools is puzzling to many, since never before in history has a student population had access to such a wide variety and depth of educational resources. Yet, at the same time, never in the history of the world have students as a whole been less informed about the world, largely due to a fixation on technology and self-interest. Those citizens who grew up between the 1950s and 1970s may recall that resources for knowledge were radios and TV sets, the daily newspaper, some magazines, the library, and an occasional visit to a museum. Students now have the Internet, which places at their disposal the contents of nearly 10,000 American public libraries, TV screens everywhere in airports, restaurants, clubs, and waiting rooms, and bookstores, both chains and individually owned. Yet despite this glut of resources, when the National Association of Scholars compared a test of current college seniors to a 1955 Gallup survey of high school students, the researchers who conducted the survey found no improvement in knowledge. Why is it that the older American students get, the worse they perform? Asked Mark Bauerlein, a professor of English at Emory University and a director of research and analysis for the National Endowment for the Arts. Bauerlein is the author of the national bestseller, The Dumbest Generation: How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. That a nation as prosperous and powerful as the United States allows young citizens to understand so little about its past and present conditions, to regard its operative laws and values so carelessly, and to patronize the best of its culture so rarely, is a sad and ominous condition. Because students are actually studying only a small percentage of their total weekly time, Bauerlein posited that the debasement of education cannot be blamed on schooling alone, but instead on the surrounding culture, socializing, games, even spending habits. Bauerlein argued that the education of the young has been subverted by a culture of conformity, peer pressure, and popular culture enhanced by burgeoning technology. Once youths enter the digital realm, the race for their attention begins, and it doesn't like to stop for a half hour with a novel or a trip to the museum, Bauerlein wrote. Digital offerings don't like to share, and tales of founding fathers and ancient battles and Gothic churches can't compete with a message from a boyfriend, photos from the party, and a new device in the Apple Store window. The Video Generation. In 2005, the Kaiser Family Foundation sponsored a report entitled Generation M, Media in the Lives of 8 to 18-Year-Olds, which theorizes that various media distract kids from serious study. Using a national representative sample of more than 2,000 third through 12th graders who completed detailed questionnaires, The report found students spending more time with new media, such as computers, the internet, and video games, without cutting time on old media, like TV, print, and music. Often, students multitasked by using more than one medium at a time. For example, working on the computer while watching TV and texting via cell phones. Some observers believed that multitasking actually made participants' minds sharper with increased mental activity. However, Mark Bauerlein noted that buried in the Kaiser report was a disturbing statistic. While 8 to 18-year-olds with high and low grades differed by only 1 minute in TV time, 186 to 187 minutes, they differed in reading time by 17 minutes, 46 to 29, a huge discrepancy in relative terms. That suggests TV doesn't have nearly the intellectual consequences that reading does. Bauerlein noted that years of TV and computer screen watching prime younger Americans for multitasking and interactivity at a deep cognitive level. Perhaps we should call this a certain kind of intelligence, a novel screen literacy, stated Bauerlein. It improves their visual acuity, their mental readiness for rushing images and updated information. At the same time, however, screen intelligence doesn't transfer well to non-screen experiences, especially the kinds that build knowledge and verbal skills. It conditions minds against quiet, concerted study, against imagination unassisted by visuals, against linear, sequential analysis of texts, against an idle afternoon with a detective story and nothing else. This explains why teenagers and 20-year-olds appear at the same time so mentally agile and culturally ignorant. The market trend of consumers resorting to audiovisuals for entertainment rather than books is evidenced in the large chain bookstores, where shelf space for books is losing out to DVDs and audio tapes. A 2004 report from the National Endowment for the Arts showed a significant decline in book reading from previous generations. Amazing as it may seem to older citizens, there are those among the younger generations who take pride in the fact that they have never read a book. Today's rising generation thinks highly of its lesser traits, wrote Bauerlein. It wears anti-intellectualism on its sleeve, pronouncing book reading an old-fashioned custom, and it snaps at people who rebuke them for it. After noting a number of surveys on knowledge before an audience of students in 2004, Bauerlein stated, "You are 6 times more likely to know who the latest American Idol is than you are to know who the Speaker of the House is." His taunting remark prompted a cry from the audience, "American Idol is more important." She was right, acknowledged Bauerlein. In her world, stars count more than the most powerful world leaders. Knowing the names and ranks of politicians gets her nowhere in her social set, and reading a book about the Roman Empire earns nothing but teasing. More than just dull and nerdish, reading is counterproductive. The middle school hallways can be as competitive and pitiless as a Wall Street trading floor or an episode of Survivor. To know a little more about popular music and malls, to sport the right fashions and host a teen blog, is a matter of survival. Dangerous teaching. The current education system seems to have forgotten about developing students' critical thinking. John Taylor Gatto, who taught school in New York City for more than 2 decades, summed up this fact of modern life in his 1992 book, Dumbing Us Down: The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. After teaching for some years, Gatto grew to understand that the education system does not exist to increase students' knowledge and power, but to diminish it. Bit by bit, I began to devise guerrilla exercises to allow the kids I taught, as many as I was able, the raw material people have always used to educate themselves: privacy, choice, freedom from surveillance, and as broad a range of situations and human associations as my limited power and resources could manage. What we are seeing is the psychologization of American education, stated an article in the April 1993 edition of Atlantic Monthly. A growing proportion of many school budgets is devoted to counseling and other psychological services. The curriculum is becoming more therapeutic. Children are taking courses in self-esteem, conflict resolution and aggression management. Parental advisory groups are conscientiously debating alternative approaches to traditional school discipline, ranging from teacher training in mediation to the introduction of metal detectors and security guards in the schools. Schools are increasingly becoming emergency rooms of the emotions devoted to repairing hearts. According to Gatto, real teaching can be dangerous. Government monopoly of schools has evolved in such a way that the premise of teaching students to think for themselves jeopardizes the total institution should it spread. The occasional teacher who attempts to instill critical thinking is merely an annoyance to the chain of command. However, should what Gatto considers the central but false assumptions underlying modern education, such as the idea that it is difficult to learn to read or that kids resist learning, and many more, be exposed, the ramifications could be extreme. The very stability of our economy is threatened by any form of education that might change the nature of the human product schools turn out. The economy school children currently expect to live under and serve would not survive a generation of young people trained, for example, to think critically, Gatto predicted. Over the years, I've come to see that whatever I thought I was doing as a teacher, most of which I actually was doing, was teaching an invisible curriculum that reinforced the myths of the school institution and those of an economy based on caste, he added. An overview of the current educational system provoked the questions, do younger people just wake up one morning and decide they are not interested in history, politics, or world events? Or does popular culture draw them away from classical education and critical thinking? Also, what is the invisible curriculum referred to by Gatto, and where did it come from? Perhaps a quick review of education history in America can provide the answer. Workers, not thinkers. Serious attention to education as a means of social control began in Europe, and with the same minds whose philosophies led to communist and Nazi totalitarianism. Education should aim at destroying free will, so that after pupils are thus schooled, they will be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished, proclaimed Johann Gottlieb Fichte in 1810. Fichte, a teacher of philosophy and psychology at Prussian University in Berlin, was a great influence on Georg Hegel and other thinkers of the period. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for more than one generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. One major influence on both Adolf Hitler and Karl Marx, as well as the modern globalists, was Georg W. F. Hegel, whose words and works have often been appropriated to justify the means of the powerful. Hegel once wrote, "The state is the absolute reality, and the individual himself has objective existence, truth, and morality only in his capacity as a member of the state." Hegel is also most noted for his Hegelian dialect, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, also known as problem, reaction, solution. The globalists, however, have bastardized Hegel's mere philosophical diagram of human interaction. Rather than wait for a problem to deal with, they create the problem, then offer a draconian solution. After compromise and negotiation, they still have advanced their agenda without the opposition realizing their design. So, could it be the case that Rockefeller's contributions to education were really part of a secret agenda to create solutions for problems that didn't exist? Any serious study may find that the American education establishment has been created and guided for many years by the same Hegel-inspired globalist elite who created both Russian communism and German National Socialism. See Jim Marr's Rule by Secrecy for further details. The oil magnate John D. Rockefeller, whose dominant oil empire was initially funded by the Rothschild-controlled National Bank of Cleveland, created the General Education Board, or GEB, in 1903 to dispense Rockefeller donations to education. By 1960, it had ceased operating as a separate entity, and its programs were rolled into the Rockefeller Foundation. In 1917, the GEB made a $6 million grant to Columbia University to create the new Lincoln School, a private experimental coeducational school in New York City. According to school literature, the facility's predecessor was founded as Lincoln School in 1917 by the Rockefeller-funded General Education Board as a pioneer experimental school for newer educational methods under the aegis of Columbia University's Teacher College. According to the late Eustace Mullins, the authorized biographer of poet Ezra Pound, who in 1948 encouraged Mullins to research globalist control in finances, health, and education, from this school descended the national network of progressive educators and social scientists whose pernicious influence closely paralleled the goals of the Communist Party, another favorite recipient of the Rockefeller millions. From its outset, the Lincoln School was described frankly as a revolutionary school for the primary and secondary schools of the entire United States. It immediately discarded all theories of education which were based on formal and well-established disciplines, that is, the McGuffey reader type of education, which worked by teaching subjects as Latin and algebra, thus teaching children to think logically about problems. Another institution of higher learning long funded by the Rockefellers is the University of Chicago, and closely connected to it is the English world's most accepted authority on everything, Encyclopedia Britannica Incorporated. In 1943, advertising executive William Benton purchased the encyclopedia and operated it as a charity for the University of Chicago, eventually contributing more than $125 million to the school. From 1945 to 1953, Benton served as a senator from Connecticut after defeating Prescott Bush, the grandfather of former President George W. Bush, and was active in global affairs. Given Benton's power and influence, it is no stretch to think that his globalist beliefs could have easily permeated those things that received his benefaction. Today, the William Benton Foundation also owns Compton's Encyclopedia and Merriam-Webster Incorporated, one of the world's leading publishers of dictionaries and thesauri. Reflecting the rise of the Internet, coupled with a general decrease in reading today, Britannica's encyclopedia sales have precipitously dropped in recent years, yet it is still regarded as one of the most credible sources of information in the Western world. The linchpin of Rockefeller's attempt to shape American education was his formation of the General Education Board and his continuing support of the University of Chicago. The creation and funding of the University of Chicago had done much to enhance Rockefeller's public relations profile among Baptists and educators. The only difficulty was that education on the whole wasn't in bad shape, explained Paolo Leone, author of The Leipzig Connection. Leone's 1993 book traced the deleterious effects of experimental psychology on the education system back to German professor of philosophy Wilhelm Maximilian Wundt, the founder of experimental psychology. The indigenous American educational system was deeply rooted in the beliefs and practices of the Puritan fathers, the Quakers, the early American patriots, and philosophers. Jefferson had maintained that in order to preserve liberty in the new nation, it was essential that its citizenry be educated, whatever their income. Throughout the country, schools were established almost immediately after the colonization of new areas. Leone noted, "Educational results far exceeded those of modern schools. One has only to read old debates in the Congressional Record or scan the books published in the 1800s to realize that our ancestors of a century ago commanded a use of the language far superior to our own. Students learned how to read not comic books, but the essays of Burke, Webster, Lincoln, Horace, Cicero. Their difficulties with grammar were overcome long before they graduated from school. And any review of a typical elementary school arithmetic textbook printed before 1910 shows dramatically that students were learning mathematical skills that few of our current high school graduates know anything about. The high school graduate of 1900 was an educated person, fluent in his language, history, and culture, possessing the skills he needed in order to succeed. According to author William H. Watkins, John D. Rockefeller Sr. was more concerned with shaping a new industrial social order than providing a useful education. The Rockefeller Group demonstrated how gift-giving could shape education and public policy, commented Watkins. Rockefeller's agenda for dumbing down the population through new education, led by his GEB, shows itself in a letter written by Frederick T. Gates, Rockefeller's choice to head the board. Gates wrote, "In our dreams we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, editors, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have an ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple as well as a very beautiful one, to train these people as we find them to a perfectly ideal life just where they are. So we will organize our children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way, in the homes, in the shops, and on the farm." As recent as 1973, psychiatrist Dr. Chester M. Pierce, speaking at a Childhood International Education seminar, echoed Gates's condescending arrogance, but went even further by proclaiming, "Every child in America entering school at the age of 5 is insane because he comes to school with certain allegiances to our founding fathers, toward our elected officials, toward his parents, toward a belief in a supernatural being, toward the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. It's up to you teachers to make all these sick children well by creating the international children of the future." Of Gates's letters, Leone stated that while it would be false to say John D. Rockefeller was a mastermind of international intrigue and deception, it would not be false to say that Rockefeller money has been used in various ways to forward social and global control through economics, foundations, the United Nations, universities, banking, industry, medicine, and, of course, education, psychology, and psychiatry. "That's a tremendous amount of control and involvement for one group," noted Leone, who then asked, "What if the theories and practices they funded and continue to fund are fundamentally flawed and don't lead to the best possible situations in the various fields mentioned?" Well, the views in most of those areas are fundamentally flawed, and they don't lead to the best solutions in mental health, education, medicine, sanity, and happiness. But, most likely, despite all humanitarian posturing, they were never intended to. Other Rockefeller-connected entities that still shape society in the United States include the Brookings Institution, the National Bureau of Economic Research, the Public Administration Clearinghouse, the Council of State Governments, and the Institute of Pacific Relations. Paul Volcker, a former Rockefeller assistant, was named chairman of the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve System, during the Carter administration and served there until 1987. Norman Dodd, now deceased, who was the director of research in 1953 through 54, for the House Select Committee to investigate foundations and comparable organizations, reported that in 1952, the president of the Ford Foundation part of the globalist syndicate working for financial, educational, and political control, told him bluntly that, operating under directive from the White House, his foundation was to use our grant-making power so as to alter our life in the United States that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. Now, with the collapse of communism and the advent of the United Nations, NATO, and other economic treaties, it seems like this globalist goal is close to becoming realized. Dodd also stated that the congressional investigation found that the Guggenheim, Ford, and Rockefeller foundations and the Carnegie Endowment were working in harmony to control education in the United States, adding that these entities had been subverted from the original goals of their creators by subsequent directors, either working for or indoctrinated by the globalists. This is yet another example of wealth taking control of existing organizations. Some of the past and current organizations and foundations that have had an impact on American education and that are linked by membership or funding to the globalist plutocracy include the Agency of International Development, American Civil Liberties Union, American Council of Race Relations, American Press Institute, Anti-Defamation League, Arab Bureau, Aspen Institute, Association of Humanistic Psychology, Battelle Memorial Institute, Center for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences, Center for Constitutional Rights, Center for Cuban Studies, Center for Democratic Institutions, Christian Socialist League, Communist League, Environmental Fund, Fabian Society, Ford Foundation, Foundation for National Progress, German Marshall Fund, Hudson Institute, Institute for Pacific Relations, Institute on Drugs, Crime, and Justice, International Institute for Strategic Studies, Mellon Institute, Metaphysical Society, Milner Group, Mont Pelerin Society, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, National Council of Churches, New World Foundation, Ayn Rand Institute, Stanford Research Institute, Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, Union of Concerned Scientists, International Red Cross, and the YMCA. According to Beverly Eichmann, a former educator, government speechwriter, and author of Walking Targets, How Our Psychologized Classrooms Are Producing a Nation of Sitting Ducks, foundation-subsidized educators like G. Stanley Hall, Abraham Flexer, John Gardner, Theodore Sizer, Ronald Havelock, John Goodland, Benjamin Bloom, and Ralph Tyler brought to the classroom the psychology principles of the World Federation of Mental Health. For openers, they worked to ensure that school curriculum and testing ditched the traditional focus on excellence in academics to concentrate on a subjective socialization, that is, socialist agenda that targeted the child's belief system. To illustrate the radical nature of this step, one need only quote from the father of modern education, John Dewey. In his acclaimed book, School and Society, he wrote, "There is no obvious social motive for the acquiring of learning, and no clear social gain at success thereat." Fast forward to 1981, and to the father of outcome-based education, Benjamin Bloom. In All Our Children Learning, Bloom averred that the purpose of education is to change the thoughts, feelings, and actions of students by challenging the students' fixed beliefs. Eichmann pointed to one example of how perceptions can be changed. Rugged individualism is an expression nobody hears much anymore, but folks used to hear it with regularity, she noted. Rugged individualism encompassed a range of characteristics: independence, self-sufficiency, thinking for oneself. In the 1970s, the axe was laid to all three. Negative terminologies like loner and misfit redefined the individualist. Independence was scrapped for interdependency, self-sufficiency for redistribution, and thinking for oneself was equated with intolerance. Today, any close reading of the newspaper reminds us daily that the loner requires psychiatric intervention, and maybe drugs as well. By 1989, the much-ballyhooed paradigm shift, as it was dubbed by behaviorist educrats, occurred in American schools. and the free world was hurled into free fall. Clandestine censorship counselors in university dorms encounter style techniques masquerading as class discussions in high schools. Massive invasions of privacy under the cover of academic testing. Value-neutral courses in ethics and world history that bestowed upon even the most heinous regimes the moral equivalence of Jeffersonian democracy. Little wonder that by the 1990s, battalions of psychiatrists were being dispatched to every school district to help contain the new brand of war games. A tsunami of school shootings and mass murders perpetrated by kids raised on a diet of behavior modification and psychiatric drugs. The changing of a student's beliefs, or behavior modification, is a technique long studied by the CIA and other agencies seeking methods of mind control. It should be obvious that to modify anyone's behavior, first one must find out what people, preferably children, are thinking, and then set about changing any offending attitudes. It has been well documented in a number of books and articles that the U.S. intelligence community has heavily influenced the American education system to propagate its views and philosophies. David N. Gibbs, an associate professor of political science at the University of Arizona, believes that influence is always supported by the distribution of money. He wrote, "While pundits never tire of the cliche that American universities are dominated by leftist faculty, who are hostile toward the objectives of established foreign policies, the reality is altogether different. The CIA has become a growing force on campus, according to a recent article in the Wall Street Journal. The agency finds it needs experts from academia and colleges pressed for cash, like the revenue. Long-standing academic inhibitions about being publicly associated with the CIA have largely disappeared. In 2002, former CIA Director Robert Gates became president of Texas A&M University, while the new president of Arizona State University, Michael Crow, was vice chairman of the agency's venture capital arm, InQtel, Inc. The CIA has created a special scholarship program for graduate students able and willing to obtain security clearances. According to the London Guardian, the primary purpose of the program is to promote disciplines that would be of use to intelligence agencies. And throughout the country, academics in several disciplines are undertaking research, often secret, for the CIA. The Constitution never states that the federal government should control education. Education should never be the responsibility of the federal government, but that of parents and local educators. Many people see government as a means to control education by selecting what to teach and what alternative theories to suppress. Many parents fear brainwashing in public or private schools. They look to schools to teach their children to be open-minded, to be able to read and write, and to fully understand the Constitution. Yet schools have often fallen short of what parents want, and rather, have seemed to embrace what John D. Rockefeller Sr. wanted. He is often quoted as saying, "I don't want a nation of thinkers. I want a nation of workers." A 2006 report by the Federation of American Scientists seemed to echo Rockefeller's request for workers over thinkers by arguing for increased use of video games in the classroom. The report stated, "Workforce globalization is rapidly expanding. The United States cannot compete in this highly connected system of global commerce on the basis of low wages, commodity products, and standardized services. It must compete by taking the lead in the next generation of knowledge creation, technologies, products and services, business models, and dynamic management systems. When individuals play modern video games and computer games, they experience environments in which they often must master the kinds of higher-order thinking and decision-making skills employers seek today." Others, such as author Beverly Eichmann, contest the idea that such games can truly prepare young persons for the workplace. Given the men behind America's education history and the mind-numbing curriculum they produced that is now used for teachers, it becomes understandable why our entire educational system merely churns out young people prepared for either wage slavery or to become teachers. The late author and media critic Neil Postman wrote, In order to understand what kind of behaviors classrooms promote, one must become accustomed to observing what, in fact, students actually do in them. What students do in a classroom is what they learn, as John Dewey would say, and what they learn to do is the classroom's message, as media commentator Marshall McLuhan would say. Now, what is it that students do in the classroom? Well, mostly they sit and listen to the teacher. Mostly they are required to believe in authorities, or at least to pretend in such belief when they take tests. Mostly they are required to remember. They are almost never required to make observations, formulate definitions, or perform any intellectual operations that go beyond repeating what someone else says is true. They are rarely encouraged to ask substantive questions, although they are permitted to ask about administrative and technical details. How long should the paper be? Does spelling count? When is the assignment due? It is practically unheard of for students to play any role in determining what problems are worth studying or what procedures of inquiry ought to be used. Examine the types of questions teachers ask in classrooms, and you will find that most of them are what might technically be called convergent questions, but what might more simply be called guess what I am thinking questions. Postman and his co-author Charles Weingartner concluded in their book Teaching as a Subversive Activity that contemporary curriculums are designed as a distraction to prevent students from knowing themselves and the world about them. And the deficiencies of a weakened education system are passed along to future teachers. It starts almost immediately, noted the two authors, because the teachers have been victims, in this case for almost 16 years, of the kind of schooling we have described as producing intellectual paraplegics. The college students, future teachers we are now talking about, are the ones who were most successful in conventional school terms. That is, they are the ones who learned best what they were required to do, to sit quietly, to accept without question whatever nonsense was inflicted on them, to ventriloquize on demand with a high degree of fidelity, to go down only on the down staircase, to speak only on signal from the teacher, and so on. All during these 16 years, they learned not to think, not to ask questions, not to figure things out for themselves. They learned to become totally dependent on teacher authority, and they learned it with dedication. Twixters. But is time consumed with DVD movies and video games, or merely regurgitating facts back to a teacher, truly preparing youth for gainful employment? Not if you pay attention to those who are called Twixters, a new word for single, middle-class, 20 to 30-plus-somethings who work in low-paying jobs, usually service, engage in serial dating, maintain old-school friendships, and generally live with their parents or room with other Twixters. Bob Shoney, a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan, has reported that the percentage of 26-year-olds living with their parents has nearly doubled from 11% to 20% since 1970. According to Shoney, youngsters between the ages 25 and 26 garner an average of $2,323 a year in financial support from their parents. Laziness and a lack of initiative cannot be totally blamed for this phenomenon. Around 1980, most financial aid for college came in the form of grants. Today, lending is the common way to gain money for education. According to a study reported in 2005 by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, college graduates in 2005 owed 85% more in student loans than in the 1990s. A Time magazine poll showed 66% of student respondents owed more than $10,000 upon graduation, and 5% owed a crippling $100,000 or more. Such numbers fail to reflect burgeoning debt for students who abuse the credit cards often sent unsolicited by the giant credit companies. According to the public policy group Demos, credit card debt for Americans aged 18 to 24 more than doubled from 1992 to 2001. With such a debt load hanging over them, it is small wonder that young people, including the Twixters, can't seem to gain the financial independence to move out of their parents' house. Given the rise of Twixterization of the nation's young adults, the widespread use of video games, computer networking sites, Twitter, MySpace, Facebook, etc., and the popular mass media, there seems to be too much competing for the attention of today's student. Add this to an overburdened and inadequate educational system, and you have a recipe for intellectual disaster. The consensus of thoughtful experts is that a dumbed-down education system produces dumbed-down teachers who produce dumbed-down students. The result is a dumbed-down population, the exact situation desired by Old Man Rockefeller and the elite globalists. The correlation is uncanny. It begs the question, is this sheer happenstance or a conscious agenda?